William Burns is a best-selling author, a magazine publisher, a New York literary publishing agent who has written and edited more than 25 books and encyclopedias in the fields of human behavior, true crime, current affairs, history, psychology, business, computing, and the paranormal. Ah, yes, the paranormal. And he is a friend. William received his PhD from New York University in 1974 while he was an instructor of English at Trenton State College. And he is currently, he just took his bar exam here in California. When will you know if you pass that, Bill?
Well, Thanksgiving, George. Good evening. And it'll either be Thanksgiving or Thanksgroaning, but I think it'll be Thanksgiving. So we'll know right around the end of November.
You know how long it has been since I had you on a complete program. I mean, you were on a little bit with our fill-in host, George Knapp, back in July. But, man, this brings me back to the old days.
That's right. We would get together on the air and basically talk through the night.
You know, back in 1997, when I first heard you on with Art and Linda Moulton Howe talking about Corso, which we're going to spend most of the night doing so tonight, it was riveting. I mean, the story was riveting. How did you come to meet Corso?
I met Corso, it's so roundabout. In fact, in this issue of the magazine, in the October issue of UFO Magazine, I talk about that. And I met Corso because I was working with a motion picture company at the time, looking to do a story, and Corso was a consultant, on MIAs in Vietnam. And Corso was, he was on the staff handling Little Switch, Big Switch at the end of the Korean War. He'd been on MacArthur's staff during the war. And he was the person who was testifying before the Dornan subcommittee at the House of Representatives, Bob Dornan's committee, on the POWs that we left behind in Vietnam. And he was the point man for Eisenhower in 1953, and basically was the person that Eisenhower told that he knew that we were leaving troops behind in Korea and in China and in the Soviet Union, F-86 Sabre jet pilots specifically, and that I was signing off on it. And Corso dropped a bombshell when he said that to the Dornan committee, and everybody was screaming, who is this crazy old guy? What does he know? He's a right-wing fanatic, blah, blah. You can imagine.
Oh, sure.
And so they did a frantic search through the National Archives to find the document that Corso said existed, and it wasn't there. And the fires got stoked up. This was back, I think, in 1995. And the fires were really getting stoked up until the one place they hadn't looked turned out to be the place where the document was sitting. It was in the Eisenhower Library. And that's where they found this presidential finding in which Eisenhower signed off on troops that we knew would never come home. And, in fact, they were living and breathing in Korea into the 90s, into the 1990s. And on the document in Ike's handwriting, it said, pass to Corso. And suddenly this obscure person, who also said there were two Lee Harvey Oswalds at a time when nobody would listen to him, became the lead story on Time and Newsweek magazine. And so we brought him in not to talk about UFOs. Who knew? We brought him in to talk about what was going on in Korea and what the policy was. And he kept on dropping these bombs about different secret programs the U.S. ran, such as using the U-2s as decoys over the Soviet Union to get them to fire their anti-aircraft missiles. I mean, he was just a wealth of information. So we're talking, and he leads us to the Kennedy assassination. He worked for Senator Richard Russell.
Yes.
And he leads us to the Kennedy assassination, told us some mind-boggling stuff about various players who were in the loop that the Warren Commission knew, told us about the conversation that LBJ and J. Edgar Hoover had in the Oval Office the day after LBJ came back from Dallas, in which Hoover said to LBJ, you know, Mr. President, we did find another Lee Harvey Oswald, and the CIA knows about it. And LBJ hushes him and says, yes, I know about that too. Let's not talk about that to Dulles. And Dulles was on the commission. And I'm telling you, so LBJ is implicated in a cover-up to conceal the identity of what really happened to the death of a president, and so is the chief law enforcement officer of the United States. Corso talks about this. The room is silent, and we're all set in this movie company group. I mean, to be blunt, this is Hollywood, and we are literally sharpening our knives and forks. We just see these movies just laying themselves out across the table like a smorgasbord. And then Corso says, oh, yes, and this is all after I handled the Roswell file at the Pentagon. Well, everybody, we just look at each other. Shut the camera off because we're videotaping him. Shut the camera off, and we basically get the 25-minute pitch on what do you mean the Roswell file at the Pentagon. And Corso unravels a story that, I mean, by now everybody knows it, but he just goes on and on and on and comes back the next day and drops a series of workbench notes on the table, and that will become Dawn of a New Age. And he just tells a story, and we were in rapt attention. And there are hours and hours of this on videotape. Some of them turned up, by the way, in the Day After Roswell documentary that was on the History Channel. But that was a smidgen, a tip of the iceberg. So he really told an incredible story, some of which he couldn't even reveal some of the names. And that's how the book started.
Was there a moment, Bill, when you were talking with him and hearing this, that you thought, how could this guy be making this up? Look at his credentials. Look at who he is. What's going on here?
Well, yes is the answer. And one of the things he did was he opened up this file folder. So here's the interesting thing. He opens up this file folder, and he spreads out his military record on the table. And we're looking at this in awe. Now, some of the stuff the other people in the room knew, his work in for MacArthur. But he starts talking about stuff that you and I heard growing up as pieces of history about another time. For example, we both know that Truman very briefly considered, MacArthur was pushing this, dropping nuclear weapons on the Korean bases, the Chinese bases,
yes.
All the mountain passes where the Chinese troops were pouring into North Vietnam and pushing MacArthur back out of Vietnam, back to Incheon. And Corso was talking about, oh, yeah, and his gravelly voice, oh, yeah, Bill, I know all that. He's talking about this, and then he starts telling you why he was the person picking certain targets. So you say, Colonel, what do you mean you were the person picking targets? And he explains that because of his artillery training in World War II, he was an intelligence officer, but he trained in artillery first, that he was assigned to MacArthur's staff as one of the targeting people to pick out which bases they were going to hit with nuclear weapons. And so we said, well, what was your consideration? And he basically said the Soviets had MiG bases, and they were supporting the Chinese air effort in North Korea. And he's talking about how we had 5 or 6 nuclear weapons that we were going to drop on the Soviet bases. And we're all kind of catching our breath and saying things like, wow, you know, wouldn't that have started a nuclear war? And he's chuckling. He's roaring with laughter. He's bouncing up. He's a little guy. He's bouncing up and down in the seat. And he starts talking about, he says the NYPD could have walked in and taken the Russians in 1950 and 1951. They were no match. He's talking about they were having so many problems. They had a nuclear weapon. They couldn't produce them. Stalin was furious. He wanted to get his troops ready. He said we missed a golden opportunity. And he sat there and he said, had we dropped those 5 nukes on those bases in Korea, there would have been the end of the Korean War. We would have never had a problem with Vietnam because there would have been no Vietnam War.
Right.
The French would not have had to leave after Dien Bien Phu. And he just rewrites history right through the 1960s.
That is amazing. All right, let's jump ahead for a bit. We're going to come back to Corso in just a moment, Bill, and so many other things to talk with you about. As the publisher of UFO Magazine, you're also getting some information that not a lot of us get, and I'm going to try to bend your arm as much as I can tonight to get some disclosure out of you. I don't know how much you can say, but you are on a melting pot of information these days, aren't you?
Yes, we are. It's really exciting. There are right now, probably 3 stories that are really bubbling to the surface with people. Will they speak? Will they come forward? Will we get to see the big it? Those are three of the stories that are bubbling, one of which involves a California Air Force base very early in the 1950s. We're really excited about this. Another story, a major magazine has promised to break. Can't say which magazine it is, but in the business that we are all in the paranormal business, you know that there is a taint to it, and you know that somebody will come forward and tell a story. I'll tell a story to Blank magazine, but I won't to UFO magazine, because everybody is going to believe, oh, UFOs, it's not true.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a story I believe it's weeks away from breaking. I could be wrong, but I think it'll be before the end of the year, in which a major magazine will break a story about a UFO sighting at an Air Force base. It's a real story with a real person who is no flake.
And you're bringing it to us here, right?
You will talk to this person on the air.
This is good. This is good. Bill, let's the 5 minutes or so to go here before the break, and I want to publicly thank you for the work you put into our book, Worker in the Light. I mean, we talk about synchronicity and how some of these things occur, and you can address some of it in what Ingo Swann was working on, and the fact that you finally realized my distant aunt had a lot to do with this entire field. But I've got to tell you, you know, this is my very first book. None of it was possible without you correcting me, fixing things, changing things, taking my ideas, adding your ideas. You did a remarkable job for us, and truly, you were the genius behind this book.
Thank you. I appreciate it, but I really want to thank you, too, and congratulate you on your first book. I think this is going to be a major bestseller. I think everybody should read the book, because in it, you're very open and honest. I mean, a lot of people will tell stories about, I'm a famous radio host, and here's how I started. It was a small station in the Midwest. But what you did was rare. You basically opened up your life, and you said, look, I had a paranormal experience when I was a very young teenager, and it's something most people don't want to discuss. As you and I know, we've talked to a lot of people, and any strange experience gets put right under the table because you're strange, you're weird, you're this, you're that. You talk about it, and you tell readers in Worker in the Light what your path was to coast, and I think that's great. I was fascinated by the story. I was fascinated how much synchronicity and the lack of coincidence played a role in your life. One of the telling stories for me that you tell in the book is how you basically defied your higher ups, when you were at a television station in Michigan, and basically thought that when you heard a story come over the wire about a ship that was missing,
the Edmund Fitzgerald,
major stories, the Edmund Fitzgerald, and there you are at the center of breaking that story to the entire world because you followed your instinct.
I seem to be falling into these all the time, Bill. I mean, like this story I had last night with Hamid Mir, the Pakistani journalist, that now CNN is all over, and they even got the contact numbers from us. I seem to just stumble into this, and I don't know why, and I don't know how, but it seems to happen to me all the time.
And one of the reasons, and you mentioned this in the book, I think. In such a way that anybody can pick up on it. This is not a guarded book. It's an open book. And one of the things you say is that you are not afraid, and I think it takes a lot of courage to say that you are not afraid to follow instinct, that sometimes there's logic and sometimes there's instinct, and sometimes the two of them disagree and you've got to make a decision. You generally tend to follow instinct because logic can be imposed upon you from elsewhere. And you talk about this in the book. But mainly, you tell everyone, don't be afraid to follow your instinct. And you do. And that's why you're breaking the stories you're breaking.
When we were able to get the cover comments from people I respect, Whitley Strieber, Uri Geller, Steve Alton, it was to me that really brought it home. When those quotes came back after they reviewed the books, and they gave us their comments. I looked at that bill and I said, this is real. This is happening. And it's a great feeling.
Well, I'm so thrilled about Uri Geller and Whitley and Steve and, of course, Tess Gerritsen stepped up.
Right.
I was really impressed. She had read the manuscript, and she knew our editor, and was thrilled about being able to write a cover quote. Uri Geller was really a gentleman. He basically stepped up, and he said to me he was not going to do just another book. He was very honest. He said he was not going to just another book about paranormal. You know, he's been in the field, he knows it all, but then he said, if this is a book about becoming a better human being and kind of reaching out beyond the confines of your own self and forming the great link with others, then he was on board. He's all about human empowerment. And the funny story is, of course, that Uri Geller, during the Hezbollah war, was on the Northern Front, and we were text messaging each other about what was going on. And he was there not to fight a war. He was there to take care of people.
Yep, exactly. We had him on briefly when a small missile hit not too close to him, not too far from him.
That's right. He mentioned, yes, and I
heard
that, and I mentioned that. And so he's a real gentleman, and I was just thrilled to have him on the cover. And, of course, Whitley is far more knowledgeable about what we're talking about in the book than most people will ever give him credit
for. He's a giant. You know, when I met him a month or so ago with you and Bob Gleason, our editor, I had talked to Whitley before, but I'd never met him. And he's got this demeanor about him. He's got this charisma about him without being, it hasn't tainted him. His success has not tainted him. His lovely wife, Anne, was with him, and she looks remarkable. It was just great to be in this group. And again, you made all this happen. And as you well know, I'm taking a portion of the proceeds, my proceeds, Bill, and I'm giving them to needy Coast to Coast listeners. We've got a list of people. The book is finally on the market. Today was the day. And that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to do that because it is more important to me to say thank you to these so many people. And I got to tell you, reading some of these emails, they're heartbreaking, absolutely heartbreaking.
I can only imagine. I get a lot of emails too from folks out there who tell me stories of how they followed their life to search for the truth of UFOs, and they're living in cars, and they've lost their jobs, and they've lost this, and the fact that you're doing this, I mean, it's just beyond generosity. It's saying to an entire audience of people, because this is a community. That's the one thing about America, is that we are a number of communities, and this is a late-night community of not just true believers, but true believers and skeptics and truth seekers, and it's a late-night community. And the fact that there are folks in this community who are in need in some cases because they do belong to this universe, this community, is really an act of generosity. I congratulate you for it, and I thank you for it.
Well, thank you, too. And that's Worker in the Light. It's in the bookstores. It's all over the place now, Amazon.com, written by Bill Burns and me. And thanks to all of you. I think you'll like it. But enough of that. When we come back, the rest of the Philip Corso story and some notes that Bill has obtained, we're going to talk about that as well. On Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie, along with Bill Burns, a co-author, Worker in the Light, and also the co-author of The Day After Roswell, publisher of UFO Magazine. How many hats do you wear, for crying out loud, Bill?
A lot, but, the weather changes, and you got to change your hat.
Well, you do a great job with UFO Magazine, and you've done a stupendous job ever since you took over. I've seen the direction of it change, the content change, and, you've turned it into an investigative magazine, and I like that.
Well, thanks. And a lot of that credit, I wish I could kind of reap it across the table, but I can't. A lot of it goes to the editor-in-chief, my wife, Nancy, who basically works very hard at getting the kinds of stories. And just for the end of this year, I mean, for example, we have potentially some, besides the ones we talked about, a really great story coming up on the Kinross case, which is the case of the jet that crashed in the Great Lakes? Was it going after a UFO? Did it get lost? We've got the photographs. The photographs are going to be pretty stunning. We have another case coming up from a publisher in which this woman who claims she has photographed aliens, I don't know, let the Coast to Coast audience, let our readers be the judge. We're going to be running those photographs, and I said to her, if these look good, I'm just going to show them to you, and if there's somebody seeing aliens, maybe you want to interview that person, I don't know. So we have some really good cases coming up. Let's see. We have some wonderful UFOs on the moon coming up before the end of the year.
Oh, that's dramatic stuff. Dramatic stuff. You know, when Ingo Swann remote viewed the moon and he saw these structures and put it in his book, Penetration, I got to tell you, Bill, I mean, if there was, you know, half of me said, come on now, what's happening to this guy? But my late aunt loved him. And I don't mean in a romantic sense, but she just loved the guy and thought he was everything that you could imagine that was right with the supernatural, the paranormal, and the unusual. She thought he was right on.
And he was. Ingo Swann, besides being a gifted psychic and a very talented artist, and you could actually visit his site on the Internet, and you will be able to see the kinds of drawings he has and the drawings he did about the aliens. But Ingo Swann tells this unbelievable story in Penetration, and it's the story he told your aunt, Dr. Caragula, about the aliens on the moon. In fact, the funny thing was when she told him that she knew all about it before he told her about it, that was pretty funny. But he goes to the moon. He's remote viewing the moon. And he actually called me back in 1998 about this to say, you know, Corso was right about aliens being on the moon because I saw them. And I, just like you, I said, yes, this is great. I knew about Ingo Swann. I knew about the books he was writing. And then he begins to describe it. Then he says something that was so chilling that, it's in Worker in the Light, but it was so chilling that it has stayed with me for almost 10 years. He said he's seeing these entities, and they're not monsters, they're not ghouls, they're not reptiles, they kind of look a lot like us, and he describes them as very robotic looking, and they're methodical, and they're kind of working on an assembly line.
What was the incredible story that he talked about meeting an extraterrestrial, seeing an extraterrestrial in a grocery store?
Oh,
now, that's got to be one of the weirdest things I've ever heard.
It is, and I'll tell you, it set my mind off in a way. I mean, it alerted me to things. He tells the story that after all of this happened on the moon, and the aliens on the moon working in this factory, he said, look up, and they see him. And he said, did he disturb some kind of a force in the universe?
And again, this is when he's remote viewing now, right?
He's remote viewing, and they look at him. And can you imagine that horrifying thing when he's kind of psychically there and invisible, but they see through his psychic camouflage, and they're watching him, and he knows they recognize him. And he said, I split that scene so fast, I broke the link. Now he's in L.A., because he flees to L.A.
Right.
Right? And I don't know what...
Where my aunt lived.
That's right. She was living here at the time. And I want to say it was in the Chalet Gourmet on Sunset. I'm not sure where. I have to ask him. But it's in arrest. It's in this supermarket. And he sees this woman who looks like an alien. And I think she's looking at over the vegetable aisle or something. She likes bananas. And she looks at him, and he looks at her, and he gets this deep, deep fear. And he gets out of there, and he tells his agency contact, and who knows what agency this is.
Right.
He tells his agency contact, this guy named Axelrod, about this alien. And he says, "Oh yes, I know about that, and you better be careful now, because she's after you." So that night, he's going to dinner at Shafika's, and he tells her the story, and your aunt says, oh, yes, be very afraid. She gets nervous.
Yeah.
She says, get out of here. And this is right about the time that he goes up to Alaska with Axelrod, and this UFO starts firing at him.
Is amazing. Great story.
It's a great story.
And she was a believer in all this. You know, when she changed her entire life, her direction. I mean, she's a medical doctor. I mean, she used to work, you know, for the government. She was from the Middle East. I mean, she knew things that most Americans have no idea has been going on over the years. She decided, I'm going to change. And she changed her entire career.
She sure did. And she became the founder. And this is no small event. She was at the center. She was at the center of the whole mass consciousness movement in California in the 50s and 60s. She literally was one of the key people who began what now today is New Age. In fact, she was the Madame Blavatsky of the entire movement in California in the 1960s, and that became New Age.
And you know what? We still really don't know as a family what really happened to her. I mean, we've always been told she was taking a bath and the radio somehow fell into the tub and she got electrocuted. Bill, I'm not so sure.
That sounds really suspicious to me. First of all, she knew an awful lot, and she told Ingo Swann that she worked for the same agencies that he was dealing with. So she was obviously in the know. She certainly knew about aliens. In fact, she was telling him, be really afraid of these aliens. They're here, they're everywhere, and they know about you. And she also made it very, very clear that there were aspects, and this is what I think the most dangerous thing. If you want to know what I think the most dangerous thing she said was, or she believed, or she knew, it was this. She said that human, and she wrote this in the book, Higher Sensory Perception, she said that human beings have abilities that human beings don't know about. It goes beyond ESP. It goes beyond something magical. Where it goes to is a whole range of abilities to get impressions, to perceive, to communicate, to see the future, to live by intuition. This is why I think that you're deciding to follow your intuition in certain areas when you get that intuition signal is such a good thing. Well, she said that. And I'm telling you, because I know from the Corso of the Navy, who's now dead, but there was a Corso in the Navy, and his name was George Hoover. And what he said was that was the secret, right then and there. And this goes right to the heart of what a caller said earlier tonight about what's going to stop the hatred. He said, this is what the government does not want you to know. That's what they want to keep from you. And now, here you are, in our generation, working in the field of mass consciousness, which is what Shafika was researching 40 years ago.
I wonder what she'd say today if she knew what I was doing now.
I think she'd be very encouraging. I think she would really prod you to go further. I think she would say, look, don't listen to the people who say that mass consciousness is dangerous, because you've been told that. I think that what she would say is you can make a kind of a spiritual breakthrough to demonstrate to people that people control their own destinies, and it is this overlay of the world. What you are told to do, you're told to walk in lockstep, you're told to be regimented, that's the enemy, that's evil, that's satanic. What you're doing is not satanic, you are trying to reach a higher level. And I think that's what's going to happen with humanity. I think that there's a general tie-in, again, not to be New Age, but that there is a kind of a general tie-in between what we're talking about with Corso, what he discovered in the Roswell file, what the folks in the Navy discovered, what other people discovered subsequent to the Roswell crash, such as Mac Magruder, who's a lieutenant colonel in the Marine Corps, who, with his class at National Air War College, went to Wright Field in late July 1947 and saw the alien. What all these folks discovered, there is a greater truth behind this. And I think that Shafika was onto that truth, and I think that she was pursuing that goal. So, of course, she was a threat.
What do you think she would have asked Philip Corso had the two of them met?
I think she would have been very specific about when you were handling the debris in that, and it was debris. I mean, we're not talking about finished products. We're talking about crash debris.
Crash pieces.
Yeah, crash pieces. When you were handling that debris in the Pentagon, what were you thinking? Because Shafika did believe that there was a presence to objects themselves. Again, it's not mystical, it's not magical, it's that objects do radiate a certain kind of an energy. They vibrate. Human beings vibrate. And that there is a scientific, there is a kind of a transfer of vibrational energy from object to person who handles it. So that's why psychics who can handle somebody's scarf and then find the person later on, that's not a mystery. She would have said, what were you thinking? Did you get any impressions? Did anything flood your mind? And Corso was very receptive to that. There are a lot of stories about that Corso told me about his quote-unquote psychic experiments. And she would have asked him about that, and I think he would have told her very bluntly how his relationship to that material went back all the way back to 1947 and through the 1950s when he was stationed in New Mexico at Red Canyon.
When Corso was talking to you, when you were putting together the manuscript for The Day After Roswell, did he ever tell you why he was doing this?
Sure. He told me why, and I had my own opinions, and I'll be frank about both. Corso fully believed that he was supposed to tell the story. Again, it's not as though the aliens were spurring him on. It's not that kind of thing. But one is that he basically was the last man standing of that group. There were others. I think there was a General Samad. One of them was suffering from Alzheimer's disease. I think this was after General Trudeau had died. In fact, he began talking about this after Trudeau had died. And Trudeau writes about this in his notes. He doesn't say aliens, of course, but he writes about what they were doing at Army R&D in his memoirs, which anybody can get, by the way, from the Army War College. Okay?
Really? Okay.
Yeah, anybody can get his memoirs. They're not classified. They're a great read. We've reprinted parts of them, by the way, in UFO Magazine and in the upcoming Dawn of a New Age that we're doing both in the United States in English and with Jaime Musan in Mexico at Planeta Publishing. We're going to have bits and pieces of Trudeau's memoirs in that. Well, and that'll be a filament ebook too as well. What Corso said was that there was a lot of confusion about what he believed happened after Roswell. But Corso's impetus, and here's where it gets interesting, he wasn't here to tell the story of aliens and alien artifacts. He was here to tell the story of how his group in Army R&D was able to outwit both the KGB and the CIA in getting this material out into the open that they wanted to harvest for themselves. So for Corso, this wasn't a UFO story. It was spy versus spy.
And he was very proud of what his department did.
Absolutely. There was no two ways about it. He said we did it above board. We did it out in the open. He said we did it the good old American way. I walked in with a chunk of money to Fort Belvoir, and I walked in with that inner lens from the alien's eyeball that they took at the Walter Reed Army Hospital during the autopsy. I walked in there, went to the site, and I said, listen, this is under secrecy. We are going to, you know, you are sworn to secrecy. National Security Act, whatever act was in force at that time. They said, yes, Colonel. He slapped the alien eyepiece down, basically slaps down a budget and says, look, there's $60 million in this for you. If you can take this, you're already working on night vision, right? Take this and develop this into a set of goggles or eyepieces or a helmet or something that our troops are going to need in Vietnam, because believe me, we're going to need this in Vietnam. The Army back in 61 knew we were going to fight.
Incredible.
In Vietnam.
How about the silicon chip? How about the laser? Did that come from all that too?
Yeah, there was a laser. He says that there was a laser cutting tool in the file. Nobody knew what that thing was. And although, in fact, the Army was working in with Columbia University. And remember that Eisenhower had been the president of Columbia University. It was kind of a holding spot for him before he got the Republican nomination in 1952. But The Army had a lab at Columbia where they were working on lasers. They were very, very primitive. And the Maser had already been discovered. It was already developed, and they were looking for applications for it. But the whole premise of this is not that Corso said, oh, look, what's this? Let's reverse engineer it and invent it. He went to the very places where those kinds of experiments were going on because he knew, they knew what to do with it. So, of course, he went to the Army lab at Columbia with this laser cutting tool, and he told them the story of scientists not knowing what it was. It burned somebody's face. They held it against a wall. They couldn't see a beam, but it began to smoke in the wall. Somebody blew smoke through the beam, and you could see the beam being illuminated, the outlines of it by the smoke itself. So it was some kind of a particle beam or a beam of waves. They knew what it was at Columbia, and that jumped them light years ahead, no pun intended, of what they were working on. Same thing with the integrated circuit. This was not anything that we were not working on in the 1960s.
Okay, 1947 was the crash. When did Corso start giving the pieces away to industry to try to duplicate this?
He came to Army R&D in 1961.
61.
And what happened was this. First of all, there was an attempt to, because he mentions this in his memoirs and in the book. He mentions that Truman, after the crash in 1947, they didn't know what they had. I mean, it's the height of the Cold War. I mean, we've gone over the story 100 times with 100 different people. Yes, it was the Cold War. It was right not to disclose it, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But Truman asked Nathan Twining, what is the least common denominator of technology that we can harvest from this? What can we do with this stuff? And I'll tell you my own doubts about this, by the way, about the story. But and they took this circuitry. They didn't know what it was. They took the circuitry to Bell Labs because they knew that Brattain and Shockley were working on something to replace what was basically the Edison tube. And if you know the Edison light bulb, the incandescent tube,
right,
that had been the mainstay of passing circuitry since the 1890s. So this was a 19th century technology, and they were working on a way to make a solid-state circuitry.
Let's talk about the propulsion when we come back, Bill, and see if they were able to find out anything. Be safe, everyone. Bill, did they ever try to tear apart the propulsion system of that crashed saucer?
Yes, they did. Corso talks about how they tried to figure out what made the thing work. And it wasn't so much whether it was a rocket engine or an atomic engine or an ion engine. It was what was the mechanism that allowed the entities that piloted this craft to control it? What was the transmission, so to speak? And they found some really intriguing things, that the craft and the pilots were linked in a mentalic way. That's to say that the pilots of the craft, the EVEs, Corso called them biological organisms. They were manufactured. That they were manufactured for prolonged space flight. They didn't have much of a digestive system. They didn't eat. They didn't really have to breathe oxygen. But they did have a brain that had pickups, biological pickups on the inside, and they found a headpiece which gave the people who first put the thing on in the Army monster headaches. It had this headpiece, and the pickups on this headpiece aligned with the various parts of the alien brain. And somehow, and he used this term, he said they didn't fly the craft, they played the craft as you would play the piano. And so the craft was enveloped in kind of an anti-gravitational envelope, and it was able to slip through space and time, that it was able to somehow fold time or pick a spot in the distance, and the distance would not just be space but time, and kind of disappear from one point and reappear at another point.
Well, something must have happened, Bill, for the craft to crash.
Well, what Corso said was, and this ties into his experience back in 1957 and 58 at Red Canyon, he said that at that time, the military, and they were experimenting with this back in the 1940s as well, in the late 40s. And it was with targeting radars, this pinpoint pencil beam radar. And apparently that pinpoint pencil beam radar had a way to disrupt the anti-gravitational envelope of the spacecraft in such a way that the craft couldn't navigate. And that made the craft flutter and become not airworthy, and they couldn't control it. So the craft didn't explode at Roswell. It basically crash-landed into the side of an arroyo. And he said that's what broke up the craft's envelope so it couldn't fly.
Now let's talk about the occupants for just a moment. Even though Corso was very concerned about the technology, and I want to find out from you if how long you think it would have taken us to get that technology if we weren't given it, just in the process of time and knowledge of the future. But the occupants, he talked about them, Bill, didn't he?
He did. He said that he believed. And this is, by the way, what's going to turn up in great detail in Dawn of a New Age, because he goes into the notes that he got from Walter Reed Army Hospital. He says that these occupants were biologically engineered to interact with the craft itself. And he said they were not they were designed like they were androids. They were designed for space flight. They had kind of a bone structure like a bird's, so that they weren't gross. They weren't heavy. They were very light. And he said they didn't need to eat. They didn't need to eliminate. They didn't have any intestinal system. He said that their hearts were very, very large. And their lungs were very large. They were primarily, they could hold whatever atmosphere they were designed to breathe, they could hold that atmosphere. It's as if they could go underwater and hold their breath, like penguins. They could hold their breath for like 15, 20, 30 minutes underwater.
Bill, were these the same beings that apparently Jackie Gleason saw when Richard Nixon took him to Homestead in Florida?
Yes, they were. And that is one of the great, great stories told to me by a mutual friend of yours and mine, who actually produced the movie with Jackie Gleason and Tom Hanks. And he said he was bugging Jackie Gleason again and again about what Gleason knew about UFOs, and he'd heard the stories. And Gleason, who was near death, it was his last movie, Gleason basically came clean and said that he was banging on Richard Nixon, who was a good friend. They were golfing buddies. They would hang out in Florida at Rebozo's place. And he said he was bugging him, show me, show me, show me. So Nixon set him up at Homestead Air Force Base. And there, he said, he saw aliens, dead aliens, and his wife, Barbara, Gleason's wife, said it so affected him, he was changed from that moment on. But apparently these were the same kinds of little grays that Corso said were in the Roswell craft.
He was never, never the same, was he?
That's exactly what his wife said. He changed. You know, it's one thing for us to say, oh, I believe, I want to see, I believe, and it's another to come into contact.
I've always tried to put myself in that mental position, Bill, to prepare myself one day if I was ever fortunate enough to see a being from another planet or another dimension, who knows where they're from. And you know what? You're right. I mean, when as much as you think you can accept it and psych yourself out, the mere fact that you would look directly at a being from another system and know that there is life out there, I mean, it is. It's mind-boggling. It's scary. It's refreshing. It makes you wonder, not about religion and about God, but it makes you wonder just how wonderful it really is.
And, that's right.
And I think it would be difficult for anybody to look upon another creature and not break down, not cry. Something would have to happen.
well, look at how all, I mean, look at the lives that have been changed by coming into contact with those creatures. I mean, Corso was one person because he did talk about coming into contact with an alien being in the 1950s, I think it was 58 or 59, 58 probably, when he was at Red Canyon. But look at the story of Betty and Barney Hill, Betty especially, because Betty, I mean, I know you know her. Yes. I knew her very well. Betty's life was so transformed. She was like the Richard Dreyfuss character in Close Encounters, where I would see her when Nancy and I were on the talk show circuit for Nancy's book Cheaper and Better. We'd see Betty on the talk shows, and she would go from show to show. This is in New England. It's Boston. People are talking. She'd go there, and she'd be carrying this alien head, and you'd see her in the green room sitting with this alien head cradled in her lap. And she'd tell anybody, she smoked like a chimney, and she'd tell anybody the story of what happened. And you could not have a conversation with Betty Hill, but that you knew that there was almost like a DNA change in her being from, and there probably was, from the moment that she and Barney were taken on that lonely road in the 1960s.
You know, it was that episode that got me going into this entire field when I was a kid, when I read about it in Look magazine.
Oh, wow, I know. We talked about it. And just imagine that. That's the other thing. I mean, you read about this in Look magazine. Can you imagine today a magazine it's going to happen, I think, before the end of the year, but a magazine of that stature putting the portraits of two people on the cover and talking about an alien abduction? I mean, for that to happen 40-plus years ago was that in itself was also amazing. And the whole funny thing was they were never the ones to tell the story. It was the correspondent who had gotten Dr. Simon's notes and told the story for the newspaper.
And, Bill, when I was 21 years old, I'm working at a little radio station in Detroit, WCAR, and I interviewed Dr. Simon. And I interviewed him over the phone, recorded it about Barney and Betty Hill, and it was a magnificent interview. And I can't find it anymore.
Oh.
I mean, he was talking about them, and Betty, of course, died just a few years ago. Barney was still alive then too. This would have been 1971. I don't, so Barney was alive then, right?
Right. Barney died in the mid-70s. I don't know that Barney actually saw the James Earl Jones movie. I don't know for sure.
Oh, I don't know. But Simon, the doctor, obviously had permission because he was telling me some incredible things about what they were saying under hypnosis. And, doctors don't talk about their patients unless their patients give them the right to do so.
That's correct. That's correct.
But I wish I had the tape.
I wish you did, too, because can you imagine the audience that night playing these tapes from 30 years ago, 35 years ago, about what Betty and Barney said? But there's a classic example. So you've got Jackie Gleason, you've got Betty and Barney Hill, and also you've got Phil Corso and others whose lives are so dramatically changed by coming into contact with a creature. I mean, just this year, we carried the story of this guy, Mac Magruder. Mac Magruder, he's another person in this group. Here is a hardened, this is what struck me. He's a hardened Marine Corps pilot. I tell you, I read his journal. Talk about astounding. I read his journal about how this guy engaged in hand-to-hand combat with a Japanese sapper crew of suicide bombers who landed at in the middle of the night at the airbase on Okinawa. Just a bloody, bloody World War II battle, right? This guy is he was a block, right? He goes to Air War College after the war, and they shoot these guys, this class, because obviously what had happened, I love these stories of what went on. Obviously the military had not yet come to a decision about what to do with the crash. They didn't know. They wanted to know, among other things. And imagine this thing is so diffuse now that no UFO czar has taken control of this. So they send this class up there to get their opinions, their feedback. And, of course, Stan Friedman has done research. We've spoken about this a couple of times. In the number of dissertations, the theses that members of this class wrote, there were some astounding dissertations coming out of Maxwell Air Force Base in the 1950s about UFOs. So this class goes up to Wright Field, and Magruder tells his grandchildren, by the way, he tells his children this story on the night we landed on the moon. His kids say to him, wow, I wonder if there's life out there. I wonder if there's life. And he says, I know there is. And he tells the story of his going into this room at Wright Field, and he sees the alien. And his kids are like wide-eyed, right, pie-eyed kids going crazy. What did it look like? He uses one word, squiggly. It had long, squiggly arms. Now, here's this rock-hard Marine Corps pilot, right, flying leatherneck, just as hard as they come, and he gets tears in his eyes, tears. And he says to his kids, we conducted tests on it, and we killed it. It was a being. Every being has a right to live. And when I heard that story from his children, all his sons told me the story, and his granddaughter. And when I heard, and he's dead now, he died in 98, a year after Corso, the same year as Corso, when I heard, he suddenly melted, right? And he tells his kids the story. It almost seemed to me that in that moment of his being in the room, seeing this live alien at Wright Field, that somehow that alien communicated a message to him. Call it telepathic, sure. I don't know. But it communicated a message to him, this is what they're doing to me. And I would have said, wow, that's incredible, and put it in my that's incredible file, except a plumber at the Roswell Army Air Base in 1947, Alpha Boyd's father, when they brought in an alien on a stretcher, looked down at this being, gave the exact same description that Mac Magruder gave of the alien at Wright Field, and looked into the alien's eyes, which were kind of like glazed over, and he said he knew at that moment that this 4-plus-foot creature was dying and communicated to him this awareness of its own death. I'm telling you, it was eerie to hear that story repeated again after so many years of interviewing Roswell witnesses.
Bill, I've always been confused. So let's assume there was a crash at Roswell. We had occupants. Why didn't their fellow extraterrestrials come back from wherever and get them?
You could come up with a lot of reasons. I mean, my main reason always was they couldn't, we wouldn't let them. I mean, it sounds silly to say that, right? Like, why couldn't they come in like Captain Kirk and Mr. Spock on a beam, right? On a transporter beam.
Sure.
They sparkle up, they get the aliens, they sparkle out. I have a really strange feeling about this, and one of the strange feelings I have, and I'll tell you why I have it, because it was one of the reasons that I doubted the whole Roswell story to begin with, because I really was a skeptic.
And this is, you mean prior to Corso?
Prior to Corso. In fact, I even had my doubts about Truman, and I can tell you why.
Okay.
But the issue was, I really don't think, and I think we will figure this out. I don't want to sound like mystical here, but I think we will figure out a lot of this after 2012. I can tell you why, but I think there's a reason for that. But I don't think they're that further advanced than we are.
Well, they have to be, Bill.
Yeah, I know they do. I know that's the logic.
And
fool would say that people who can travel between vast stellar distances wouldn't be very advanced. But ask yourself this question. This is what bothers me. This is the one thing that bothers me. Besides the fact that Truman in his private diary never writes about Roswell, that's my own private – I have a problem with that. But the issue is – when we are harvesting their technology, we're harvesting – you asked the question before, how many years ahead did it jump us?
Mm-hmm.
Well, what if it jumped us only 50 years ahead? Well, we didn't jump 1,000 years ahead or
no.
A million years ahead. We jumped, what, 50 years ahead? We're already working on a laser. We're already working on AT&T at that point was experimenting back in the 60s and the late 50s with something called fiber optics.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, a fiber optic junction was in the Roswell debris. Corser said they would shine a light through one end, and it would come out in reds and greens or reds and blues on the other end of this Y yoke that they had. When you think about this, why would they – here's the big issue. Here's what bothers me. Why would they be using silicon-based transistor technology for a craft when we in a lab, our scientists have now gone beyond that? You talk to Charles Ostman.
Right?
You talk to Charles Ostman, we're at a nano level of technology that's astounding in terms of where we were in the 1940s. We are experimenting now, and I think you'll see this in the next 10 years, we're experimenting now with carbon-based circuitry. Can you imagine growing life forms? We're talking about various kinds of molecular bits that can turn themselves on and off, that can turn into ones and zeros, so we could actually program them in some kind of a biological assembler language. If that's the case, we now, our technology now is beyond the technology of the, in some respects, of the craft that crashed at Roswell. So that's what interests me about this. And I'm just wondering why is, is there a disconnect? Am I not seeing something? I don't know.
And the fact that they got here, you know, they would have to have been so advanced, but there's a stranger picture here, Bill. I don't know.
There is. I mean, Ingo got to the moon. I mean, that's the thing that really gets you. Paul Smith, you interviewed Paul Smith,
yes,
on Coast. You and I interviewed Paul Smith together for UFO Magazine, and he wrote his book, Reading the Enemy's Mind, that folks could find in bookstores and at Filament. The point is that here's a guy who talks about, now this is in the 1980s.
Stay with us, Bill. Let's take this quick break. We'll be right back. Where did they get here, Bill? Where did they come from?
Good question. I've always thought that Betty Hill was right, that they came from the star system that she said existed before we discovered there was a star system there. Zeta Reticuli. I mean, I think that's where they came from. And Corso said that the Army didn't know in the 1960s, and that he followed the Betty Hill story pretty closely, and he believed that too.
And again, we were talking about the propulsion right before the break.
Yes. He thought that an interesting observation was and this was, of course, after he didn't know. I mean, the big thing was the Army couldn't figure it out. They had a sense that these craft were able to generate an anti-magnetic, anti-gravity envelope. And it was this envelope, and they could focus at a certain point in space-time and slip, like fold a continuum as if it were kind of a piece of paper and go from one point to the next, so they could literally drop out of time and space into another dimension and wind up at a point that they'd navigated to, so they could make space jumps. In other words, like Isaac Asimov in Foundation, in that trilogy, they would make space jumps. And he said that was the most plausible thing. That's what the Army believed. And they were able to navigate these space jumps, not because they had this elaborate equipment that could do that, but because the engines, the propulsion system, the navigation system was somehow tied in directly to their minds, and they could literally play the ship across predetermined spots in space-time wherever they had to go. Now, yes, that's pretty advanced. I'm wondering how close we are to that now.
When Corso was getting close to passing on, did he say anything else, Bill? Did he change anything?
He didn't change his story at all. What he talked about more, I mean, there's a whole backstory, as you know, and everybody does know, to Corso. There was the lawsuit. There was what happened in Italy. There was a whole bunch of stuff. But what Corso did say, he knew that he was dying. And what most people don't know is that Corso knew he was dying in 1997. We had a big conference with him and some engineers in Colorado in 1995 when we decided to do The Day After Roswell. The movie company put this together. And this is where Corso dropped on the table this report of a UFO retrieval by the United States Army that took place someplace in Texas. And he literally, I don't know who gave it to him, but this was in this kind of 1970s dot matrix print, so it kind of had the smell that it was real to it, right?
Mm-hmm.
And he drops this on the table, and you're reading an after-action report by some Army unit, I don't know what unit it was, but about how they approached the craft, and I have to tell you that when you read something that about what this unit had done before. So these weren't a bunch of Keystone cops figuring out what to do next, like War of the Worlds, would something open and some tentacle come out. This was a pretty standard military operation in which this unit knew what it was doing, knew where to post its people, and what each person's job was in this retrieval. So Corso drops this. Now, at the time, Corso was, I mean, I'm telling you, this guy was sharp. He could pick out, I mean, he could recall any fact, any point.
Even up to the moment of death, I bet.
It was pretty close.
Yeah.
Where he started to slip was in very early spring, 1997. He had a terrible bout. He had a herniated diaphragm, which meant that his diaphragm would roll up to his lungs and he would have hemorrhaging. And he'd had this through a large portion of his life, didn't know why he had it. He'd have to go in for operations, but it was taking his toll. In spring 97, right before the manuscript went to Simon & Schuster, we had to spend a day in Florida where he was going through it. This is why there's so many errors in the manuscript, and I freely admit that to everybody, that there are errors in the manuscript. It's been for the past 10 years, people have picked it out, and they're right. We were going through reconciling various manuscripts together. We had four of them spread on the floor of this hotel room, and the air conditioner was really turned up high because he was really sick. And he said to me, very basically, look, I'm not going to be around that much longer. Nobody was in the room. He said, I'm not going to be around that much longer. He said, you know that I'm sick. And I'd known that when he'd flown back from Colorado in 95, his son had told me that he had hemorrhaged on the plane
and
took him right to the hospital. So he was ailing. His mind was sharp. He just was physically ailing. And his wife had died a few years earlier, and he was living with his children. And so he told me that he really felt that he didn't have that much time, and he really wanted to make sure that in the next edition of Day After Roswell, that he would be able to make the corrections that he couldn't make in this manuscript. He said, look, you were wrong on a couple of things, the names of Russian bombers and that kind of stuff. So and at the end, he'd gotten very angry. We can talk about the lawsuit and why. But he'd gotten very angry, and that was one of the reasons for Peter Gersten was using Corso in an affidavit in 1998 as part of a lawsuit to try and get information under the Freedom of Information
Act. Right, because Peter was and still is with Cause, right?
Yes, that was one of the Cause affidavits.
Citizens Against UFO Secrecy.
Correct. And Peter was using that to get some. He was filing a lawsuit, partly I think it had to do with the Phoenix Lights. And he was trying to get information out. And Corso signed an affidavit that was dead wrong. And he knew it, and I knew it, and I believe that Peter knew it. And it said that he was on the National Security Council, and he never was. He was a staff worker. And he said to me, this was at depositions for this ongoing lawsuit. It was like a Charles Dickens novel. This lawsuit went on so long. And he said to me, it really doesn't matter because I'm not going to be here. I can feel something. And that's what he said. He was very cryptic about
it. Well, he was right.
But he was right. And he had two heart attacks. And he died before he was to appear in Roswell in 1998. But toward the end, he was very, very mystical. And he said, look, you have my notes. You have all my notes. You know exactly what's in my notes. You've gone over them. He says, they're yours. You take care of them. Get them out in the best way you can. And that's what we're doing in Dawn of a New Age and some of the other books.
Now, tell us about these notes. How much do they differ from the original book?
They don't. They go into more detail. They're, how can I put it, they're peripheral in many cases to what's in the book. For example, in the notes, Corso talks a lot more, and this is what's so stunning, and it's why I brought Paul Smith up earlier. Corso talks a lot more about the Army psychic exercises or the enterprises in the Army, the psychic enterprises in the Army, all the way back in the 1960s, which predated the work that Ingo Swann talked, going back to Work in the Light, which talked about, predated the work that Ingo Swann and Harold Puthoff did at Stanford Research Institute late in the 1970s, before the Army officially started remote viewing at Fort Meade in the 1980s. So this predates that by about 10 years. And what he talks about in Dawn of a New Age is the Army's fear that the Soviets were working on multiple reentry vehicles,
mm-hmm.
and how they could have groups of psychics turn these vehicles so that our radars would predict an impact of nuclear detonation in Washington, and it was really going to be in Atlanta, because they had the ability to make these determinations. They could affect them psychically. Now, whether the Soviets could actually do that, well, that's a question for Yuri Geller, actually.
Sure.
Whether the Soviets can actually do that, or whether that was part of their propaganda, I don't know. But he said the Army took it really seriously. And so one of the things, and talking about group consciousness and mass concentration, exactly what you did with the hurricane in Louisiana a couple of years ago,
yes.
and with the Beltway snipers in Maryland, the Army was working on ways to get groups of psychic viewers, he called them, to counteract what the Soviet psychic viewers were doing, to be able to direct anti-missile missiles at the last minute to these devices to prevent them from detonating. So the notes go into that a great deal, talking about the Army anti-missile, the psychic anti-missile missile program. They go into what Corso was working on, which is interesting. It has less to do with UFOs and more to do with the Cold War, but Corso's missile activities at Red Canyon in the 1960s, why he believed that UFOs were really time ships and not spaceships. It goes exactly to what George Hoover and the Navy said about what the Navy believed about UFOs. And it ties right into the whole mythology surrounding the Philadelphia experiment. And he talks about that. He talks about his relationship with Admiral Arleigh Burke and why Admiral Arleigh Burke himself was so frightened about what the Navy found out during the degaussing experiment on the USS Eldridge in the Philadelphia Navy Yard.
Yeah.
What happened, why it winked out of radar, what that meant. I mean, we now have our own opinions, but Corso writes about that. But mainly he's writing about why he believes and why Herman Oberth told him that, remember, he was part of Paperclip, why Oberth told him that these were not spaceships but time ships, because they knew in Germany, and here's what we didn't go into in Day After Roswell, because the Germans knew, because they had been working, they had come into knowledge of this, that there was an alien presence and that there was technology that could be harvested from the aliens, and that the aliens had mastered not space travel but time travel, more important than space
travel. Now, that's interesting, that whole area. Did Corso ever talk about other visitations by extraterrestrials, or was it just the Roswell case?
No, he talked about others. He talked about the crash at San Agustin. He talked about Socorro. He said there were other crashes, that crashes were, not uncommon, because of our experimentation with radars. And he explained that that was why, when he was at the Red Canyon Army Missile Base in the late 1950s, that his unit was told to turn their radars off at specific times. And they were odd times. It's like 12:53 and 10 seconds. Turn your radars off and leave them off for 11.2 minutes. And then you can turn them on again. And Corso, who was never really, who really liked to push the envelope, is the best way to describe this. He would have his sergeant kind of hang back for maybe another 5-10 seconds, because he wanted to know why there were these odd times. So he found out that there were all these strange targets overhead, and he couldn't figure out what these targets were. So he had his people save the radar tapes. And when he had a chance to look these over, he said he knew that we were turning our targeting radars off at certain points because we knew that there would be overflights of these craft. And our targeting radars somehow interfered with their ability to navigate. And what they didn't want, he believed, this was his, he surmised, they didn't want another repeat of Roswell and other crashes, because we didn't know the power of our own targeting radars. And so he talks about that a lot in Dawn of a New Age. And he talks about the alien in the cave.
Let's talk about that again.
I can tell you, I to this day cannot reconcile this story.
The alien in a cave.
The alien in the cave. I to this very day cannot reconcile this story. This is the story of your world if you can take it. Corso, I believe this actually could have been an experiment done on him. I've got my own private feelings.
On him?
On him. I have my own private feelings. I have to say, something, when you read Lieutenant General Trudeau's notes, I'll be very blunt about this. Those notes open up. They open up like a vein of gold in a mine. They open up the story of the Army's, the military, but the Army specifically, experimentation with hallucinogenic drugs
right.
from the early 1950s, the early 1950s, all the way through the 1970s.
Do you think they were experimenting on Corso?
I think they were experimenting with members of the Army general staff.
All right, let's assume for a moment they did with him. Could that explain these wild ideas, that turned into the book The Day After Roswell? I mean, could he have perceived it, believed it?
I think, in my own mind, they're separate. But I think one of the things they were playing around with, if this is an experiment, okay, now this could well be real. Corso talks about going into a cave, and there's a story of the lost gold mine in around White Sands.
And we're not talking about the cave I broadcast from in St. Louis.
You're not talking about that cave.
Not that.
Because if an alien turned up in that cave, that would be a story, right? Then
yes, sir.
Bigger than the Edmund Fitzgerald. But there is a cave, and Corso had the ability. He had his own pilot, and he would. And it was an Army. I want to say it's a Piper Cub, but I could be wrong. And they were flying this kind of observation plane over the missile range. And Corso would always overfly the missile range. He wanted to make sure there were no strays, no people on there, no guards, because they would literally bring the warheads down on this range, and he was overflying this, and he saw an object that was shimmering in the desert out there. Gets his pilot to fly back, gets his staff car, drives back out to this object. And he talked about this object in the desert, and he said it was kind of elliptical shaped, silver. And he approaches it, and he looks at it, and he said, somehow, if you could picture an object like this, that it didn't belong. I mean, these are his words. This is in Dawn of a New Age.
All right.
It didn't belong in the place where it was. Now, that's a very cryptic thing to say. It's almost as though whatever brought that object kind of imposed it digitally. Sounds wacky. Imposed it digitally on the scene where Corso was. So he said it didn't belong there, but it was real. It was palpable. He walks up to it. It's a blazing, blazing hot New Mexico day. We all know what these are like in the summer. It's blazing hot New Mexico day in the desert. And he walks up to this, and he touches it, which was a wacky thing to do, but he touches it, and it's ice cold. And he can't figure out why this thing is ice cold. And he pulls back from it, turns away, and he turns back, and it's gone. And he is so tired, so weary, that he basically says, I've got to sit down someplace. This heat is really getting to me. And he goes into this, and there are all these caves out there. He walks into this cave on the side of a hill. It's really the side of a hill. And he walks into this cave in the side of a hill, and he wants to get a drink of a groundwater, and the cave is cool, so he kind of sits, leans back against the rock, and he sees what he believes to be a kind of an entity
inside
the cave, and it looks humanoid. He doesn't describe it as this is not the alien he said that he saw at Fort Riley in 1947 when he went into the veterinary barn. He just described it. He said it looks humanoid, and he's got a sidearm, and this is a restricted area.
All right, let me let you finish it when we come right back, Bill, and we'll open up the phone lines. You must have a question of Bill Burns. You can talk with him about the day after Roswell, UFO questions. He's the publisher of UFO Magazine. If you want to talk with him about our book, Worker in the Light, go ahead. We'll open up the phone lines. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Bill, before we go to the phones, let's talk again about that possibility of disclosure that could occur in conjunction with another major publication. What are the odds? What do you think?
I think the odds are something like 98-2 in favor of this. They have the story. I know that I have a story too. I mean, I have the story. I know the story. They want to do it. And I will tell you, there will be a firestorm of reaction when the story comes out. Just a firestorm. Because nobody would dare disclose this kind of stuff at an Air Force base. Somebody of any kind of reputation. And behind that, this is why I know this stuff is real. Behind that, there is, the best way to describe this as conversations going on about what to do about at least one craft that they quote unquote have, and just really what to do about it. You've got these people who are saying, let's disclose. Then they have a little conference among academics and scientists about this, and the pro-disclosure people walk around saying, nope, can't do it, too soon. So, I mean, these are the discussions going on now in official centers of the government. So this is not myth. This is absolute reality.
What's holding them back, at least, for doing it right now?
Well, it's one of the things George Hoover told me straight out is that George Hoover was the Corso of the Navy. He's dead. He was Walt Disney's advisor on the Men in Space show. Okay, he was the guy the Office of Naval Intelligence talked about in conjunction with the Morris K. Jessup story of the Philadelphia experiment. George Hoover said that there were two major, major issues. One was that, and we touched on this in Worker a little bit, one is that human beings have the same capacities as the aliens have because, and here's the big one, we are the aliens. That's what he said. That's what the Navy believed. And he said, we have the ability to manipulate time. This is why I think 2012 is important. We have the ability to manipulate time, to change the future. And as experiments we talk about, I mean, Shafika talked about this. She talked about experiments being done in Canada. We talk about these, about human intentionality actually changing the future. He said that's what the aliens brought. This is what George Hoover said. That's what the aliens brought. And that our government in particular, but other governments of the world, are scared to death over this. because they don't want us to have that, because they're afraid of what we will do with this power.
All right, to the phones we go. We'll go to our first-time caller line. You're on the air with Bill Burns on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Is this me?
Yes, sir. Hi.
Okay. Hey, I had a question about what he said earlier about, you know, in Roswell, maybe the thing got shot down by a radio wave or a beam.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering if Bill thought that was still a weapon that, if, you know, think about War of the Worlds, if that was a weapon we may be still developing or using.
Yeah, the answer is yes. This is a weapon we're developing. We have been using these now for probably about 20 years as weapons. We are in the early stages of, in fact, it's not so early. We just haven't deployed it yet.
Right.
But we are, quote-unquote, in the early stages of having a directed particle beam weapon.
So it's kind of like an accident. We stumbled across it.
We discovered that pencil-thin targeting radars can affect a lot more than simply painting something.
Right, because you said, like, the Nazis may have been investigating this.
Well,
Nazis lost the war of the battle for England because the West had the radar first.
That's correct, and in fact, we had radar in the Pacific and were able to identify the Japanese fleet.
Yes,
and do anything about
it.
Yes.
And the second question was, when you're talking about like somewhere between that and the guy in the desert on LSD or whatever, about the cold metal.
Yes.
But then you had said that the guy had they were talking about were the alien technology infused their minds through like almost like a molten technology.
Corso said that the object in the desert was ice cold to the touch, which he couldn't figure out why, because it was a blazing hot day.
Right.
Then he goes into
the
cave.
When you think about like our technology that we know, like mercury or like heavy metals.
Right.
Like, their melting points are totally different.
Correct.
Metal, it's almost like the Terminator movies. Like, a heavy metal has to be extremely cold to be solid.
That's right. Or does it have to be extremely cold to be able to make those dimensional jumps, which Corso said they were making. Yes, exactly.
And so when they put the helmets on, they got the headaches, because mercury is like a poison.
That could well be. These were kind of like headbands. You know, you see these joggers wearing headbands. These were headbands that had metallic pickups.
Right. Yeah, so like the colder the metal, the heavier the element.
That could well be. Or there could have been some kind of a signal that it was looking for in the human brain. And of course, these guys in the army didn't have the kinds of manufactured brains with the pickups that the aliens had. So they were sending a signal, and they were getting headaches. There were like beams going through their brains. They couldn't figure out why.
Bill, I'll let you finish up in the alien in the cave story from last hour.
Okay, so Corso goes into this cave, and he's dead tired now. And he leans against the rock, and he sees this figure, and this figure moves. You know, when he described it to me, it sounded like the clay people from Flash Gordon, right? So this, so the figure moves. And Corso is carrying a sidearm, and this is a restricted area, draws the sidearm, and he literally says something on the order of, who are you, friend or foe, identify yourself. But he does say friend or foe. It's the standard army sentry identification. And this entity, this creature, says neither. And Corso, who actually is a very funny guy, I mean, he would tell stories. That's for another time, but he's a really funny guy. Corso goes, what do you mean neither? You know, it's like, you can't say that. You're either a friend or a foe, okay? You can't be neither. No such thing as neither. So the alien says, put down your weapon. And Corso says, what do you give me if I do that? In other words, what's in it for me?
Exactly.
Put down my weapon.
Yeah.
Right. So the alien says, your world, if you can take it. And Corso puts down his weapon, and the alien basically says, you're not ready for your world, and literally kind of disappears out of the cave. And Corso said to me that we're writing the book, he says, I tell you, this was no dream, but I was so tired that I could have sworn it was some kind of a dream vision, and he didn't know. He tells the story. He told it to George Knapp in Las Vegas. He tells the story. He tells it to Paula Harris. But literally, he confided to me, I do not know if this was really a dream or if it really happened. I come down on the side of reality because I couldn't have dreamed something that strange.
That is strange. Next up, East of the Rockies, you're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Good evening, George and William. This is David from Connecticut.
Hi, David.
Hi. I have a theory. You know, aliens are abducting us, and I'm wondering if they're enhancing us, changing our makeup, making us into a hybrid, into like a lizard or a praying mantis. And it's just a theory of mine.
I don't know if they're turning us into insectoids, but the theory is that you're correct in one respect, that what aliens are doing who are abducting us are almost like engendering us, impregnating women, engendering us to breed the next generation of human beings that are closer to alien hybrids. And that's the story behind the Indigo children, and that's the story behind the Crystal children, that are this generation's kind of improved model of Indigo children.
I'm just wondering if they're trying to really, there's just one type of alien, and they're just trying to throw us off, that they think that there are many different type of aliens instead of just one type of alien.
According to this person we talked about earlier, Lieutenant Colonel Mac Magruder, he said that he was told at Roswell. Now, that's a mind blower, and that's responsive to what you're asking, but it's a mind blower because why would they tell him this in 1947? That bothers me. How did they know? Maybe he was told later. But there were three different alien species, two of which were kind of halfway between benevolent and who cares, you know? Like, they were really kind of not benevolent, not hostile. They were just here. You know, they were here for the beer or something. But there was one group of aliens that was definitely hostile to human beings because they wanted the natural resources from this planet. So, yes, there are different alien species. At least that's what this one Marine colonel said.
I see. Okay, that's all. Thank you very much.
Okay, appreciate you being part of the program. Bill, what do you work on in the future now? I mean, you've got the Worker in the Light. That's done for us now. What's next on your plate?
Can I talk about our novel?
Yeah, sure.
Let's talk about our novel. We are writing a novel, a time travel novel, where Worker in the Light is nonfiction about time travel. I mean, that's one of the aspects we cover in Worker in the Light. We talk about this. We talk about Shafika's experiments and her research. What we do in Nero Blaze, who was a time traveler, is we take this to the next stage because George and I have been talking about this for years, wanting to write a novel about our theories about time travel. We really have theories. And what we did was we decided, let's put them together in a novel. We've been working on this for a while, and it's coming out after next year, late next year maybe. We're talking about a novel in which we have a time traveler who is kind of an Indiana Jones but younger, who really stumbles upon the secret of the Illuminati. And, in fact, that's why he has to travel in time, because he's running away from the Illuminati who've had this secret for eons.
And the fun part was kicking around so many ideas of how he was going to time travel, whether it was, and I'm not going to give it away, but how he was able to do it. And then we changed so many different aspects of it, Bill, in terms of if he went back into time, what would he do? What would he change? And that I mean, I had fun working with you on that part. And we're about, 60% done?
Yeah, easily. And the thing about it is we basically put together something based on what we talked about in Worker, which is it's the conundrum. What happens when you change the future? What happens when you change the past? Do you disappear? or do you create a new timeline? And that's what our hero finds out when he changes the past and the future.
Next up, let's go to our wild card line. Welcome to Coast. You're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hi, this is Walt in Evansville, Indiana.
Hello, Walt. Thanks for calling.
Bill, I have a question for you. And this hit me right when I read the Corso book a couple of years ago. Roswell happened in 47. He got this stuff out of a filing cabinet in 60. That's 13 years. What happened?
Ah, great question. And here's the answer. In 1947, Truman wanted this common denominator, the lowest common denominator for what the technology was. So the Army took this debris to Brittain and Shockley over at Western Electric, Bell Labs.
Mm-hmm.
Brittain and Shockley calmly figured out, oh, my God, that's the secret. The secret was so simple. It was every time they tried to get electrons to pass through a circuit, they couldn't control the electron flow, and it would go two ways because they were using a silicon base. They found out that the basic craft circuitry had been, it was a mixture of silicon with arsenic. They were doping the silicon with arsenic. That's what helped them control the electron flow. They did it. What did AT&T do, or Bell Labs do? They promptly patented the transistor.
Mm-hmm.
They patented it. In fact, there's the Roswell crash. There's a patent in 1948. And in 1949, everybody's walking around the beach holding those little transistor radios to their ears.
That's right.
Okay? And they patented it. The Army went livid. And the Army said, you patented something. It came from outer space. You can't do it. And for 13 years, they sat on it. Then.
Really?
Yes. And
wow.
Then after Arthur Trudeau, after his, he was the head of Army G2, right?
Yeah.
We don't have the time to go into his story at G2, but after he moved from G2 to this backwater command of Army R&D, he realizes, one, that in 1956, the Army had a plan to put a fortified base on the moon, and two, we've been sitting on Roswell debris. He goes to Strom Thurmond in the Senate, and he says to Strom Thurmond, who is a friend of his, he says, let's turn some of this into weapons. This is incredible stuff. Strom Thurmond says to him, we can't turn it into weapons. I will not give you one thin dime to turn it into a weapon because it's not invented here. Put this into your brain between your ears. It's not invented here. Now, go figure out a way to invent it here. That was the basis for Corso's work at Army R&D, reinventing it here. That was reverse engineering. Strom Thurmond promptly applied gazillions of dollars to a budget to get this stuff invented here as Trudeau restarted what the Army had stopped 13 years earlier.
Kind of a second follow-up here. Is there the possibility, though, that somebody was thinking during these 10, 13 years, and is that maybe how the secret, we'll call it the black ops, the whole separate world that got developed quite possibly? Because Corso was regular Army, regular guy. You know, everything was standard. Could a parallel exploitation of this technology have happened, do you think?
Well, the answer is yes. There were parallel exploitations of this technology in the three branches of the military because the Navy had its own Corso. He was their time travel guy, George Hoover.
Yeah.
The Air Force was developing this. The Air Force went deep blue real fast. And the CIA was developing it because the CIA was so panicked about what the Soviets might know from this because, remember, both the Soviets and the Allies partook of their share from the Germans at the end of World War II. So we didn't know what the Soviets had.
Good point. Hey, Bill, we're going to take this last break, then we'll be back with final phone calls. Fast night. It goes by quickly. Do you feel that?
Yes, it did. This really sped by.
It did. Hey, when I come back, too, I want to talk with you about these large triangular-shaped objects. You have your own thoughts on
that. I sure do.
And a lot of people have seen this. I still believe one of these might have been seen over Philadelphia, Phoenix years ago. Maybe Philadelphia, too. They're all over the country. I'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast, west of the Rockies. Let us begin. You're on with Bill Burns. Hi there.
Howdy. This is Greg, listening on KNY in Juneau, Alaska.
Hey, Greg.
Yeah, calling in reference to the time machines being with related to the UFOs. And, you know, our concept of time is based on the rotation of the solar system and the sun and the moon, and how that would relate to the spaceships or UFOs having different cylinders revolving around them or cyclotrons in the same fashion as the time machine was constructed under H.G. Wells.
What do you think, Bill?
I think that they used it in a different way. I understand how H.G. Wells conceived of the time machine, and, of course, we all know the Wa-Ming Chang model of that for the George Powell movie. But what the aliens had, what we believe the aliens had, was the ability to fold space-time, to go from one point on the space-time continuum to another space-time continuum. And to do that, Bob Lazar said they used the element 115 to freeze time and create kind of a hole in time, a vacuum in time, into which the ship actually slid, which would comport with what Kenneth Arnold saw over Mount Rainier in 1947 when the disc-shaped, when the actual delta-shaped objects seemed to wink in and out of time as if they were skipping across water.
Bill, what's your take on these large black triangular objects we see? A lot of people are reporting them, have been over the years.
Yeah, these are the ones that were floating up and down were floating in the air up and down the Hudson River and into New York City back in the 1980s. And, of course, were these the same objects over in the Phoenix skies that Dr. Kitai writes about in her book about the Phoenix Lights?
Yes, Millstadt, Illinois, the police officers saw something years ago as well.
That's right. Now, there is one theory which I believe accounts for part of this, and that is that the Air Force has been developing neutral buoyancy triangular aircraft for years. And the premise of this and they're camouflaged on the bottom so that when you look up at them, you see kind of like a vision of the night sky, of a starry sky through it because it's night camouflage. And that the Air Force has been developing this for years. And one of the premises is it is both a battle platform, not like Battlestar Galactica, but kind of like a battle platform to be able to take out satellites and have looked down tungsten rods from God, kill rods. But also as a transport, imagine being able to transport huge amounts of troops, battalion-sized units, from the middle of Kansas to the Gulf in a matter of hours. And in peacetime, it's the ultimate FedEx van.
I love it. Great phrase. Next up, let's go to our wild card line. You're on Coast to Coast with us. Hello there.
Hi. My question is for Bill. Basically,
yeah, sure.
The only thing that really stops me from believing everything about extraterrestrials or extra-dimensionals is that if you look at the government reports, there's basically just one type of alien. I mean, in the more believable government reports, 4 feet tall, you know, the basically a gray, correct?
Yes.
But if you look at private reports, there's just a buffet of aliens. There's reptilians, blues, reds, Andromedans, Pleiadians. I mean, where do you think that disconnect really comes in?
Well, first of all, I think that there are aliens that we are in business with, and there are aliens that we're not in business with. And I think that what we see in the reports, which I really think is the tip of the iceberg, that there's a much deeper vein. I know where the vein is, but there's a much deeper vein somewhere. And that is that there are alien groups, alien species that kind of move through here that we have no control over. By control, I mean we're not dealing with them. And there are aliens that we are, and the grays and the associates of the grays are those that we really have a relationship with. And that's why you see the different the disc disconnect, which you correctly point out in the reports.
Oh, okay. That's a decent explanation.
Okay, appreciate you being on the program. Next up, east of the Rockies, you're on Coast to Coast with us. Hi there.
Hey, George.
Yeah.
Hey, Bill.
Welcome to the show, sir.
Hey, how you guys doing tonight?
Good, good.
Fantastic show. It's every bit as exciting as the magazine. In fact,
thank
I was reading the UFO 20 magazine you have there tonight, and it was sent to me by Sean Castile.
Oh, good.
You know, and I'm hoping Coast will put him on the show sometime.
Oh, absolutely.
The article in the magazine with Mr. X. It was an interview with Mr. X.
Right.
They mentioned something called SERPA, and I was wondering what that was.
SERPA was, if you had all week, you could be talking about this.
And that's a weird one. It's still kicking around, too, isn't it?
It's been, this has been around for, watch Close Encounters of the Third Kind, again. SERPA is a story that has been circulating. It popped up. First of all, the essence of SERPA is this, that in the 1960s, a group of cosmonauts, U.S. cosmonauts, were taken aboard an alien spacecraft. Let's say that this was the group that landed at Kingman, Arizona in 1952, and taken aboard a spacecraft and taken to the home planet of this alien group called SERPO. And this group was called the Evens. And this group of cosmonauts lived on SERPO for, 10, 15 years. One of the cosmonauts died, and then they were brought back, and the project was so secret that they never even, that the reports, the red book or the green book, the yellow book, they were kept under lock and key. And now the story is just being filtered out because the last of these voyagers have died, and their material is now being filtered out. That's
wow.
The story of SERPO. And you can get that, by the way, if you want that, a shameless plug. If you want that, go to www.ufomag.com, ufomag.com. Go
sure.
to the website. On the page, you'll see the SERPO issue. Click it, download it, buy it. It's all yours.
Well, I'm on the site right now, and I do have that magazine.
There you go. Okay, so you can just you could buy SERPO. But that's where the story is. Now, here's the thing about SERPO. Is it true? Well, the story bears a great deal of resemblance to a lot of other stories that were circulating in the 1970s and 80s.
Okay.
One in particular was that came out of U.S. intelligence agencies. And remember, we were fighting this Cold War with the Soviets.
Yeah.
And we were kind of like, who's bigger? Who's the bigger gorilla here, right? Who's
right.
the 800-pound gorilla? And one of the theories is that the SERPO story was concocted by the National Security or by the CIA or the National Security Agency. I don't know which one, but it was concocted by them and then leaked as a way to frighten the other side in the Cold War into believing that we had the juice. In other words, we were the ones dealing with the aliens, so you know, you mess with us and they're going to pound you to smithereens because we got to deal with these guys.
Uh-huh. Oh, that's absolutely amazing.
Okay, and that was I tend to fall into the group that believes that.
We probably had that information anyways, no?
Well, you know, look at it. I mean, these are creatures called Ebens, and we call the creatures in the Majestic 12 papers extraterrestrial biological entities, EBEs. So, I mean, there was so much correlation between what's in the MJ-12 papers, assuming that they're real and true, but what's in the MJ-12 papers and what's in the SERPO story that you almost think that there's a concoction there. And the level of technology on this planet, here are people who basically can whisk our folks back to this planet, and they're playing soccer, for God's sakes.
Wow. Wow. Hey, Bill, I didn't catch all of the show tonight. Did you talk about 2012 at all?
I mentioned 2012. I mean, we write about it in Worker in the Light. I really do believe that by 2012, call me crazy, but I believe that one of the reasons for it is that we will have discovered, it will become a form of common knowledge of time travel.
That'll be a great day.
And time as we know it will change. The society is not going to be destroyed. There's not going to be a big nuke. The world is not going to vanish. The timeline will change.
Do you believe in the massive...
In the folks who are discovering Atlantis now, Sarmast, that whole group out in the Mediterranean, and I am hearing these incredible stories. Their book is in filament, but I'm hearing these incredible stories about the kinds of technology they're finding in that city. So I believe that we have already traveled into the past.
Bill, anything new on the Dan Barish case, how bizarre it is?
That continues to really... I mean, every time you hit that story, this group just goes wild with fury. It's like probing a nerve in a sore tooth. The thing is that I'm still waiting for the magic PhD from Dan Barish. Supposedly, I've heard that Dan got a job as a research biochemist somewhere, and, of course, that proves the story is true. I don't know how, but it proves the story is true. I would love to see a PhD. I would love to see his degree. I'd love to hear from one of the professors at Stony Brook that this guy went there when he spent like 5 minutes in high school, then got an equivalency diploma, then went to UNLV. So I'd love to hear about it. But there's really no major revelation about an alien landing has come out of the Barish group.
Wildcard Line, your turn on Coast to Coast. Hi there. Hello?
Yes.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yes. This is Tony from Lafayette, Tennessee.
Yeah, Tony.
And I got kind of a direct link with Fort Riley, Kansas.
Okay.
My father was stationed there in 1970. And I was informed when I was pretty young. I'm 35 now. And actually, I was talking to my mother tonight about while they was there. And I found out that there was a colonel there that when my dad was stationed there with my mother, that she had an operation there. And from that operation, it was the second operation ever performed on a woman, and I was conceived a year later. And I just wonder, with all the stuff that Corso had seen there and everything, if Fort Riley was a kind of a mecca of just strange things happening.
What Corso told me was that Fort Riley was a major intelligence center. I mean, that's where he went to intelligence school when he was captain. So there was a lot going on there because it was a center of Army intelligence, of Army G2 intelligence training back in the 1940s and 1950s, and that it had remained kind of a central facility for the Army straight, obviously through the war it was very important, and it just remained a major research facility for the Army and a major dispensary kind of facility. It was really central, both for its geographic location and because it really sat astride all the major routes from the southwest to the northeast.
Bill, why was my aunt afraid of extraterrestrials? What did she know?
She knew what Ingo Swann discovered, and that is that they were here. They had a power over us. They were manipulating us, and I believe the really big secret that your aunt knew and that Ingo knows is this, that these are not creatures that turn up in your bedroom late at night. These are creatures who are integrated with our society. Walt Andrus, former head of MUFON, believed this. I believe it too. That you can literally, just like Ingo, walk into a market and you'll see an alien buying produce. They're in our society. It's not that they're shapeshifters per se. They look like us. And they are wielding our society in ways like the Foundationers were able to do in the Isaac Asimov novel. I fully believe that Asimov was tuned in, that this is not just fiction, that our society is being manipulated, that we are going towards an end. There is a purpose, and that there are aliens among us who are able to affect marginal things in our society. It's not as though the sky is going to change, the sun's going to rise in the west, but they're able to affect things on the edge. Life is on the margins, and what they're able to do is do that so that society is going to point and evolve in a certain direction, and they are controlling us, and they're here.
Well,
and that's what Shafika knew.
I'm watching a picture of the NASA robotic arm and camera looking at the space shuttle to make sure there are no loose tiles. So far, all looks good there.
That's good.
Have not seen any. Let's go to another final caller. Let's go to our first-time caller line. I've got about a minute. Go ahead.
Hi, my name's John. I'm in Austin, Texas. I live in Lubbock, Texas. But I used to be in the U.S. Air Force, and it was rumored throughout my squadron there at Carswell Air Force Base in Fort Worth, Texas, that some of the spacecraft UFO parts from Roswell had been put there underground in all the old storage tanks. And I was wondering to how factual that could have been.
Have you heard that, Bill?
Yes, I have. I heard that parts from UFOs are stored in two places. Carswell was one of them, and the other place was Eglin Air Force Base, because there is a huge cryogenic chamber there, and that is where a lot of these were. But Carswell was one of the bases, I have heard it, too, where UFO parts were stored. Yes.
And I got to believe that they are all gone now. What do you think?
I have heard they're still at Eglin Air Force Base.
Very good. Hey, Bill, thank you so much. Congratulations to you again on Worker in the Light, because without you, there would have been a worker in the dark.
Well, thank you. It's a wonderful book. Congratulations to you for really being able to tell the wonderful story of your own career and what motivated you. And I will see you soon.
Next one, partner. Thanks a lot, Bill.
Bye-bye.
Take care. For Steve Carr, Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Laudasur, Dan Brady, Ross Mitchell, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell, and the rest of the people in the White Pages, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.